You're listening to the Doctor Who podcast from Castle Davros. I'm Christian Corley. With me is James McLean. And we're delighted to welcome back onto the show Gareth Cavanagh. Gareth, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's been horribly busy. So just the chance to just have a relaxing chat with a couple of pals about nothing apropos Christmas is grand.
Excellent. Now, we just had a brief chat about this. Over the past few weeks, James and I have, forensically analysed every episode of Doctor Who. That didn't happen. But we've had a chat about each preceding episode. And we've come to a general conclusion that it was all right. And we certainly seem to enjoy most of the episodes. But Gareth, you're watching not with us and not talking with us. Until now, how did you find Doctor Who Flux?
I enjoyed absolutely all of the ingredients. I thought certain episodes like Keeping Everyone were brilliant. I loved the posh glam rock villains. I loved everything. I just didn't understand the ending. And I just seemed to didn't quite fall apart, but it was sort of, it felt like a kind of wave of the hand it will do. So, you know, the bloke with the tunnel, couldn't quite understand what the point of him was, other than it made for quite a useful device for moving around things. The fella and his wife didn't appear to be. I couldn't see what their point was, and the Grand Serpent guy, unless he was some brilliant misdirection for the Master, and then at one point I thought, ooh, maybe he's going to be, you know, the sort of the backstory of the glam rock people. And he was neither. He was just kind of bloke.
Yeah.
He turned up, to, you know, it almost felt like, oh, we can get him from Line of Duty. What we got? Oh, nothing really, but let me come up with something. But I enjoyed all the ingredients. I just thought it was a shame it just didn't really have an ending. Well, not an ending that I understood. Maybe other people did understand it, but I didn't get it. Did you understand the ending?
I would say I was dissatisfied with the ending. It certainly didn't all fall into place the way we maybe had hoped it had. But I think it was quite a ambitious thing to do with Doctor Who. And I think overall, I think they pulled it off. It's just the ending just didn't quite slot through the letterbox, did it?
I was going to say, I think to me I felt like it, as I've said before, it needed like two more episodes. If it was going to copy the Netflix structure, it should have been at least eight. And then you'd have had space, I think, to do what it was trying to do in the last two episodes. And I think also it felt a bit like he wanted to do things with UNIT before he left the show. And he didn't have any space to do anything with UNIT as he had planned. So he sort of wedged it into the flux. Because the UNIT storyline with the Grand Serpent and Lethbridge Stewart just wasn't needed in there. It felt like something that was that he wanted to do, that he was indulging himself in more than it was necessary, and it just clogged everything up. Because you take away the UNIT, you take away Grand Serpent, you have a lot of running time to dedicate to the rest of it, and that to me was probably one of the big problems. Is yeah, the Grand Serpent was just not needed, nor was UNIT.
I agree with all that. I mean, there's a popular theory that it was originally eight parts, isn't there? And that they had to condense to six because of COVID. But he didn't quite chuck all of the storylines overboard. Because, yeah, you don't need... I mean, UNIT appears to be... The UNIT and Grand Serpent thing is fun, but it doesn't... You don't need it. It doesn't literally doesn't do anything. If it did exist, then nothing would change about that story. And you might have had a bit more time with Kevin McNally's professor, I thought was brilliant. He was absolutely a breakout character. I could have watched 6 hours of him, the other two, very happily, and been thoroughly entertained. So yeah, I think maybe it is a victim of cuts to the episode running overlapping. But that aside, and killing all the dogs off screen, you know. I have flushed the face. You are the last. It's like, well, that would have been nice to see. But I guess that would have been half an episode in itself.
That's a good point. And maybe the COVID stuff is behind it. Because it does feel like as I was saying the other week, you know, Act One finishes at the end of Episode Three rather than Episode Two for a six-parter. And since Act One and Act Two kind of feel like they're quite well structured and flowing, and then you get to the last couple of episodes and it just goes crazy, like the show normally does. And it does feel like, yeah, maybe it is missing something. It feels like rather than there's been chops throughout the story, it feels like the end has had chops and therefore it cannot successfully, but it's not been chopped well or not well enough. But I don't know.
You know, I mean, when you have to cut things, I mean, it's that old cliche, you know, you kill your darlings, and
yeah,
you're right. You know, the thing that goes is Unit and the Grand Serpent, despite the fact you've got him from Line of Duty, you know, the evil doctor, despite the fact that you've got something you want to say about Unit, and it's like a fun story in it. That would have made like a fun 45-minute story in itself. Just that's the bit that, yeah, that has to go. And you would have been better off showing the last stand of that would have made for a more satisfying end for Carvin Easter and all, you know, and that instead of like just a, it's a bit like, do you remember when Rome suddenly got its budget cut in series two and they compact series two and three into series two? So it suddenly becomes, instead of epic battles, you get some legionnaire turns up and goes, "The battle is won, my liege. The price was very high." And then they go, "Oh, what a shame." And then you have and it felt a lot like that. So it's a shame, but I think as a format, it's brilliant. The idea of it felt a lot more modern. The old sort of, here's 10, 45-minute self-contained stories, and maybe there's a little light linking arc occasionally. That feels quite old-fashioned now, whereas a single story that is satisfying and fits together, and in theory you could watch in one sitting and enjoy, it feels the correct space for Doctor Who to be in there.
Well, it was a format that was like 4 years out of date when Davis took it on. I mean, yeah, this is sort of late 90s format of the the Buffy.
Yeah.
So it's well out of date for them to be still using it.
Well, it's a bit like the DVDs, isn't it? You know, Doctor Who DVDs are released in silver cases for the first time in 1999, and then the poor buggers are stuck with that silver case for, you know, 16 years or however long the releases went on, because that now has to be a complete set. So it's funny how the decisions you make at the beginning on this particular show means you're absolutely stuck with it forever, it would seem.
Generally enjoyed the episodes, and we also had some people on Facebook contribute their comments to it, and I think generally speaking the audience seemed to like it as well. And I know I've seen some of the audience appreciation scores, and they were strangely not as high as I expected them to be, and the ratings haven't been tip top for it either. James and I had a brief exchange a few days ago about we've not really talked about the ratings for this season Doctor Who, but we did have a quick exchange on WhatsApp, didn't we, about Strictly Come Dancing ratings, which don't seem to have changed, which is kind of interesting, isn't it?
That says a lot about the Strictly audience. The Strictly audience, I was older, it is family, it is solidly in the house on a Saturday night, it is fairly analog in that it is watching television as it is to it in the schedule. Whereas I think, you know, Doctor Who is on a Sunday night. It's being encouraged to be consumed on iPlayer.
Mm-hmm.
So I've gone past the point of panicking about ratings.
Yeah.
And AI, because I think it's almost meaningless. I think it sort of makes more sense now that the format is good for streaming and is perfectly suited. Something that's going to have a longevity, and I think now it probably is.
And it's also 16 years old. I mean, it's a drama which has been going more or less every year for 16 years. You're not going to get the numbers as predicted that you would get in 2007 when a show is 4 years old and is very fresh and exciting to the viewing populace. So you're never going to see massive ratings at this point. And I agree with you. I mean, this is the reason why, you know, factual entertainment has become a big thing, because it's fairly cheap. It has mass market appeal. It appeals to wide ranges of audience. And that's perfect for broadcasting. But, you know, drama is now largely very much a narrowcast thing, especially sci-fi drama. So, again, what Strictly does is not what Doctor Who could do. They're not in the same ballpark. And pretty much nothing hits what Strictly does anyway. Strictly is the unusual one. So I think for people to look at Strictly and go, well, Strictly's doing this, but Doctor Who's doing this, is you're really taking the exception to the rule and then comparing it to a sci-fi drama which has to compete against now literally hundreds of other quality sci-fi dramas. Ooh. on a platform that young people don't use anymore.
And Strictly is live, you know, or is presented as live. So it's I mean, I watched the latest episode of Succession on Sky Atlantic last night, and it felt really strange having to switch on at 9 o'clock and watch it and sit through adverts and it finished. I couldn't do any of these things. I had to watch it. And I thought, this is actually quite odd. I would rather watch this at a time when I know no interruptions. I haven't got stuff to do. I haven't got an event to cancel. I haven't got tweets to reply to. I can watch it. And it felt odd. Now, the only things that I watch live, you know, guaranteed nowadays, and I feel a little bit dirty saying this, because I was, you know, I was a big fan of scheduled TV and the shared cultural experience. Pretty much the only things I can guarantee to watch live is football, because you just have to, because otherwise you've got that lightly lad scenario where all you need to do is glance at the score or someone flashes it up on Twitter and there's no point watching that match 6 hours later. Or the news, and you just turn on the news and you see what's happening at that particular moment. Everything else, I think I would rather wait until I've got the optimum moment to enjoy that and watch it. The only thing that I think Doctor Who is missing is I particularly enjoy being able to then watch 2-3 episodes in one hit, because I'm in a really good place and I'm enjoying the drama. I still find the interruption of a week, you know, it doesn't quite know what it is. It wants the benefits of streaming, but it isn't optimized for that platform yet. But I'm sure it will come, because the second part of your very good point about Doctor Who being 16 years old is, what the hell does Russell do to bring it back up to the level? Because if Russell does an all bells and whistles, you know, BAFTA winning quality, big feels Doctor Who, and then it hits 4 million people, everyone's going to go, ooh, dud. So the metric has got to change for how we measure, is this a good show? Is it a popular show? Does it have a big future in terrestrial and streaming? And I think that until they decide which camp they're in, they're never going to really, you know, Doctor Who's going to be a hostage to fortune.
How do you see the new 2023 Doctor Who? Did you have any ideas or any suspicions about what Rusty Davies might do?
I had a chat to a couple of people, and no one knows for sure, but the theory I like is that, you know, it's no secret he's a big fan of the MCU stuff, but where the MCU really works and the theory behind it and where the popular thinking is where he will go with it is that you're never more than a couple of months from new content. Mm-hmm. The problem we are with just one show with production breaks. So, you know, so you've got Hawkeye and then you've got, you've got the films. Then you've got the next streaming spin-off, then you've got another streaming spin-off, then you've got a film. So I think what we're going to be looking at are, and this is where the Bad Wolf co-production makes sense, is you're going to be looking at 4 or 5 things in production simultaneously, different spin-offs that all knit together, some lightly, some more heavily, some for different audiences, some very sophisticated, some more child-friendly, some more fun, some more dark. And that's the which to be fair, he did try to do back in 2006, but he was trying to do it before streaming platforms existed. He was trying to give us that MCU experience, but, you know, by doing it on BBC One, BBC Two, and BBC Three simultaneously, or BBC One, BBC Three and CBBC simultaneously. So that's the popular theory, but to build this brand back up and give it awareness and eyeballs and oomph, you've got to have content almost continuously coming at you. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's his approach and that's his mission, because if you're coming back to Doctor Who, it's the big risk. And I don't think it can just be, hey, here's a series every year or every 2 years.
Yeah.
Literally looking at a premiere every 4 to 6 months.
That's interesting.
That's what we said, wasn't it, a few weeks ago? Yeah. So we're all on the same page. Yeah. This is he's not going back just to do something he's already done. This is to do something which hasn't been done, which interests him. And invariably, as you say, you know, the way that the markets are going, and especially what you can give to your corporation, is going to be looking at how do you modernize the show into something which delivers content that benefits BBC as much as it does the audience, in terms of, you know, where the market's at. And Doctor Who is not where the market's at. And that's got to be looking at an IP and going, this franchise has got many crannies and nooks that we can explore and utilize. And how do we do it in a way of generating content that, yeah, is interconnected, that is ongoing, that speaks to a range of people, can, you know, has global options. I think it's interesting to hear that what your vibes are very much what we were kind of hoping they would be. Well, not hoping, what we were expecting them to be.
I think it has to be, you know, and I think this is where casting, you know, is going to be, we're going to see a big bump up in casting. I mean, nothing wrong with the doctors that we've had so far, but by and large, these have been names that are TV names that are well known in the UK. And I think you've got to look at something which has an eye to an international market. A name that you wouldn't look out of place if you were walking past the Odeon and saw a quad poster in a frame for Doctor Who, whatever.
Oh no, it's going to be Hugh Grant, isn't it?
I'd be okay with that. Well, I wonder if he's a bit old now.
Yeah, he probably is, isn't he?
You know, but someone of that—it's someone of that recognisability and that heft. You know, God, I mean, who? I mean, Tilda Swinton was the big rumour 3-4 years ago. And someone like that, you know, you could say, yeah, that green light's a movie. So I think they have to think bigger. I mean, and let's be honest, in the BBC's IP locker, there isn't much that's big. You know, no one is going to be wanting a sort of streaming multi-platform EastEnders. Although, I mean, it's it. They appear to have Top Gear, which is great, got good, you know, international potential. Strictly is there. Great, good international potential, and Doctor Who. And I can't think of many others, because most British BBC dramas have, by their nature, been small and domestic, made for small domestic audiences. Yeah. Doctor Who, I think, is it. And they're not grasping it. I can't understand. I can't see that Russell would come back otherwise, unless it is let's bang this not just to the next level. Let's look this, you know, let's scale the mountain, and in 10 years time look back and, you know, almost have a snigger that we could only make Doctor Who every 2 years for 6 episodes.
But I think what could be interesting is if we go back to the Flux and we have the introduction, the very strong introduction of multiple universes, the multiverses, it gives, if they continue with that, it gives him a platform where he can do a 6-part McGann story. And McGann can be older because it can be a McGann from in that multiverse. You know, they can do the what if for Doctor Who. They can play around with its IP in a way which they could do anyway, because, you know, who cares if McGann looks older? But you can sort of play around with things which can be concurrent in terms and synchronized without having to be in continuity.
I mean, look what they've done with Star Trek. J.J. Abrams gets them out of the cul-de-sac with a movie that no one remembers, really. No one really remembers that 2009 Star Trek movie. But that idea that time changes, everything you've seen happened and exists and could still happen, but now it's all changed. So your past is valid and complete, but here's a new future we're going with. And Doctor Who, dealing with time travel, could do that. And between that and the multiverse, it's all there to do. I mean, Russell had it all set up, of course, in 2009, didn't he? With the US reboot of Doctor Who, but he'd set it up with a spare Doctor and Rose in the alternate universe, which would let the British come back to their version of Doctor Who if they wanted in the future, and it still worked nicely alongside, you know, Alt, Tennant and Rose. So it's all there to do, and you're right. It will let people enjoy the current incarnation of Doctor Who, or whichever incarnation of Doctor Who, and does not devalidate any of those things that they've enjoyed. But it also sets them a little bit free to chart a new course. It's exciting.
I was just looking at, you may know, guys, that Netflix has recently started publishing hours view ratings, and this is happening in November. It doesn't really give a great idea of what's going on compared to sort of analog TV, we'll call it. So the first one they published was November the 8th to November the 14th, and they had things like Red Notice at the top. Down at number 9, Transformers The Last Night. Really? Nearly 7 million hours viewed of Transformers The Last Night. I mean, that's like a three-year-old movie that was, or might be more than that, but it was terrible when it came out. Why? How has it got? I don't understand how it's got nearly 7 million hours. It's
comfort viewing, though. I mean, come on. How many times have you watched Peep Show on Netflix? Unless I'm just alone. I quite often come in, sometimes after a few lagers, sometimes not, and what's on Netflix, and it kind of knows, it knows that I'm quite likely to gravitate towards Peep Show. It's always near the top, and I'll go, ah, Peep Show, comforting. And before you know it, you've watched the whole of Peep Show again. Again. It's like a doom loop. So I guess if you're in your 20s or your teens, and you've come in after a couple of sherbets, then Transformers is their version of Peep Show, or our version of blowing the dust off image of the Fendal and sticking it in the DVD player.
Yeah, but Transformers The Last Night is terrible.
But people watch these weird old movies, don't they, on Netflix? And that is technically an old movie, isn't it?
Well, I guess.
I think the other thing is that the metrics aren't clear. Well, again, it's a different metric now, but the metrics still aren't clear. You can look at hours watched, but that does not necessarily mean, from the view of the company, what is successful or what they want to engineer going forward. I mean, you look at Cowboy Bebop, which has been cancelled. And again, that it didn't do badly in terms of hours watched, as far as I'm aware, but either its critical success or the costs of it, you know, has meant it's something which has been considered unviable. And yet, you know, shows like Shadow and Bone, which to me are mind-blowingly flat, it moves on to a second season. So it's one of those weird things where hours watch gives you an indication, but like you say, it doesn't really give you information as to, it doesn't really give you what they're getting. It only gives you a part of the puzzle, and how that works and who's actually watching that as well would be interesting. Yeah. You know, it could be young kids.
Who's watching?
I don't know.
Is it a small audience that's watching all of it, or is it a big audience that's watching the first episode and not coming back? You know,
is it? I mean, I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm aware, thinking just off the top of my head, Transformers seems to be a fairly Netflix zoned content. So again, it's like what shows are leading people into subscribing, and it can be that some shows, you know, Cowboy Bebop has not had a very good audience review or lukewarm critic review. Is that going to lead people into subscribing, or does it lower the value of the subscription? If people are interested in Transformers and or that sort of genre, and Netflix has pretty much sort of closed systemed it, so it's only available in that space, then that's going to be something they're going to be pushing, and it's probably going to have higher numbers because they can't be seen anywhere else. So I think it's just interesting, like, what do these figures mean, and how does that function, or how do they function in relation to what is kept on, what is, you know, bought in, what is sold out? It's interesting.
If you were looking, I guess, to greenlit a sequel, you'd look at the numbers, and you'd look at the overall numbers, and you'd go, overall numbers good. And then you go, well, let's look at who's watching it. And you go, okay, that's our audience, that's good. Then I guess you'd be looking at, right, how many people actually made it to the end of the run that watched all 8 episodes, as opposed to watch 1 or half of 1 or maybe the first 2. And if that number was vanishingly small, you know, if only like a third of your viewers actually made it to the end, you'd probably think maybe we won't spend another 50 million quid doing series two, because next time that number is going to be smaller because nobody's going to come back and watch it. Or maybe you think, well, maybe we need three series of content for people to watch it. The Expanse is one that mystifies me. I quite enjoyed the first couple of series. I don't know where we are now. I think the last but one where they were through the wormhole, I watched the first three episodes with Vern Gorman kind of, you know, doing his Vern Gorman thing. And I think I gave up after three episodes, and I've not considered watching the Expanse since. I just thought I can't sit through any more like this terrible three or four episodes, and I'm out. So maybe it is a cruel thing, the streaming as well. It's a merciless platform, which again makes it more difficult for Doctor Who's got to be right, and it's got to have multiple hooks, and it's got to have lots of little series, you know, and it's got to have a Mandalorian or a, you know, something that appeals to different bits of that universe. Fascinating.
It is, and I think that is, you know, and we've said this before on the podcast, is the crux for me. For Doctor Who, it's like at the moment I've got to have a bit of free time, and suddenly I'm just realise how much material I've got to watch. You know, I'm there's, you know, as you say, The Expanse has come on, which I'm still watching. I foolishly started watching Titans on Netflix, which is fairly flat and not amazing, not dissimilar to Gotham. But you know, you end up starting to watch that. I want to finish Lost in Space. Final Space was quite a good animation. I want to finish that. I'm on the last season of that. We've got Boba Fett this month. We've got The Witcher this week. There's just multiple, you know, the material that's coming out is so saturated that if something starts to lose your interest a little bit, there's a good chance that you'll drop it for something else. So again, that might be another factor when looking at hours, as you say, is how much of the series is been watched, because if they're not getting to the end, then they're probably stopping watching that and watching something else, and that something else could be on another streamer. And now, you know, with Paramount Plus coming in, you know, later, early next year, you're going to have another bit of competition in a market which is already quite saturated, and that's going to make it even more merciless as to what is kept, you know, where the money goes.
Well, do you know, I have to say, I was a big fan of the idea of BritBox, but having now lived with BritBox for, whatever, 18 months, and seeing, A, how poor the platform is, how pedestrian the content is, and how unusable the platform is, and it keeps bloody signing you out and all kinds of irritation. I really wish BritBox didn't exist now. And if they really wanted to make Doctor Who huge, God, you would just... You'd put it on Netflix or one of the biggest streaming platforms and build that audience. You wouldn't just lock it up on this dreadful pygmy platform that eventually is going to go. Because I can't imagine it's hitting anywhere near the numbers to suit anyway.
The user interface is absolutely horrendous on Netflix.
It's really bad. It's been bad from day one. It's still bad.
Disney's net interface is terrible as well, which is amazing since that's, you know, the biggest empire at the moment.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But Netflix, but BritBox felt uniquely rushed and utterly terrible. I remember when I first got it, I remember trying to watch a couple of Doctor Who's, and it would play part one and then randomly stop, and you couldn't get on to parts two, three, or four, or you'd go on part one and part four would pop up. It feels like the same mistakes being made. Is that people aren't thinking, how can we make this as big as we can? It's like, oh no, how can we get as many $5.99s off people as we can get and stuff the brand?
Well, Disney's incredible, because if you've got a show you're watching, say Golden Girls, and you're like halfway through season four, and you think, I want to go and watch one in season two, if you click on the ongoing watch, you can't actually get to the episode list. You actually either have to have it in your watch list, or you have to search for Golden Girls to locate it, to go through, you know, and it's just incredible how bad these are. I mean, iPlayer was phenomenally bad. I mean, I know that there were certain distributors who wouldn't allow certain shows on iPlayer because there was concerns of its poor security.
Player actually worked, though, and this was like the irritation for me when BritBox launched. It's like, you already have a... ITV Player works. you know, you already have a player that works. Why on earth are you building a new custom player that doesn't work when you could just go up the corridor and license iPlayer or license ITV player? Oh, this is terrible. Are we going to call this podcast Three Old Men Moan About Streaming Things?
Well, I think it's pretty good because it's three old men not moaning about, you know, something from the past. It's about sort of, it's a fairly up-to-date moan. we're on the pulse here.
Here's an interesting thing. Okay, Life on Mars, you can watch it on BritBox. Ashes to Ashes, you can watch on BBC iPlayer. No one's thought that through, have they?
That makes loads of sense, doesn't it? is that because... Is that because stuff expires after 12 months?
I presume it's something to do with contracts and expires, but it just makes no sense that you've got to subscribe to BritBox to watch Life on Mars, but, you know, if you've got license, TV license, you just watch Ashes to Ashes whenever you like.
I'm pretty sure both are on either Prime or Netflix as well. So, again, it gets even weirder that you can get the full content by going away from BBC products, streamers, and going to an independent streamer.
Sarah Jane Adventures is another one. It was on iPlayer for years, and then it suddenly stopped. And then a few months ago, it turned up on BritBox.
They've moved Father Brown as well from iPlayer.
Really?
Yeah. And it kind of bugs me a bit, because I think there's a, you know, okay, now I am starting to sound like an old man, but, you know, I don't want to go on about license fee, but there seems to be something a little cheeky about taking shows which are still relatively current and then paywalling them behind when you've already got people who are actually, like, you know, paying a license fee on top. There's arguments either way on that, but, you know, particularly when I kind of fancied like watching Father Brown, this argument was very much in my head, and I realized I couldn't because it was now paywalled behind BritBox, and I've got Netflix, I've got Prime, I've got Disney at the moment. I am not going to get BritBox.
No, it's not on, is it? And actually, this is before we even did the actually excellent UK TV player, which is free.
Yeah.
And now I've become completely addicted to vintage EastEnders from 1998 and 1999 in the last few months.
Redefining the word vintage there, but carry on.
Oh, no. This is...
No, we're not. Christian, you're vintage. That is vintage. You're going to have to deal with that.
It is vintage. And Terry Raymond, you know, the Terry and Irene, Terry Raymond, he's bloody fantastic. And that, I get so much pleasure out of it. Just, you know, here in my freezing cold mad attic, you know, I literally just, you know, get into bed, get as warm as I can, and watch three or four vintage enders. And I think it is fair to call it vintage. In a way that Coronation Street in the same period is not vintage. It's dreadful. Incidentally, I caught a Coronation Street last night. Bloody hell. I mean, I felt embarrassed watching it. It's so overwritten. You know, the characters just talk as if it's one great big huge non-stop Victoria Wood sketch. Honestly, it's just beyond awful. And I thought, who is this being written for anymore? And I'd imagine, you know, there will be, you know, angry Coronation Street podcasts out there, you know, ranting about, oh, we need to get back to that classic, you know, Bill Podmore era. That's what we want, real characters and plots, not this rubbish. I was shocked at how far it had dropped. And so, and maybe EastEnders has become like that now, but Enders from the late 90s, I'm enjoying it.
What still blows me away about Coronation Street, because I actually was with family watching 85 and 86 just out of interest, and was just going back because they've been watching it recently, and The Rover's Return. And I know I'm in the minority on this, but it really kind of upsets me. Still, even now today, does not work. It's a building which makes no sense.
You mean it's spatial dimensions?
It's spatial dimensions inside make no sense, and they still make no sense. The toilets still go into the next door's flat. You know, the kitchen area, which apparently they don't show much anymore, still would spill out onto the side street. And, you know, initially when it used to have its own function room, which again would have gone out across the road. And no one ever cares about this. It really upsets me.
Continuity is really poor in Coronation Street. It from a sort of from a built
from a spatial sense, really poor.
it doesn't make sense at all. Doctor Who is a lot stronger in perspective, you know, isn't it?
Doctor Who has an organic component, which means it can do weirdy stuff like that. But Coronation Street, the Queen Vic still has similar problems, not as bad, but they are present. I mean, I've written on this, you know, and Golden Girls is obviously the worst of them all. But, you know, these things matter. You know, how can you comfortably feel the realism of a space, the truthfulness of a space, if the space doesn't make sense? But apparently it doesn't matter. And Coronation Street's still doing it. So people don't care. It's like, can't you see it?
It's a fair point, I suppose. I always love the old function room on Coronation Street, trying to work out where it actually was.
Well, yeah, it goes across the street. Literally, you'd have to... I mean, you could even find the plans. I've had a look at various floor plans, obviously, to see how far it extends out across, because it's on the corner of a street, and how far it extends across the road to make that work make sense.
Maybe...
Because you think where the door is.
They drag it out like an awning when they need to use the function room and close the street. They just drag it out the side of the pub.
Well, that's it. Well, if you think where the bar is in relation to the front window, so when they go back into the kitchen area, and for a long time there was the stairwell, which was, and around that area, it would just sprawl out. It's incredible. And as I say, the toilets going into the next terrace is just... It is fascinating. And again, as you've said before, you know, that's why someone like me gets upset about this and still can't get over the fact that the Millennium Falcon A doesn't match its interior size to its exterior size is very upsetting for the full-scale model. And also that the cockpit actually extends in Empire Strikes Back on the interior but doesn't on the exterior to fit, obviously, the far more scenes with multiple people in the cockpit in that film. Again, is very, very upsetting. And Life on Mars is your only escape, is by seeing these as afterlives, as purgatories, where things don't have to necessarily make sense. And, you know,
solved it. And, you know, I suppose that, you know, I suppose the lesson here is that franchises and programs get the fan bases they deserve.
Quite possibly.
Yes. That's worrying, isn't it? Yes.
I was watching a video on YouTube the other day. It was a really cool video, not directly related to what we were talking to, but James just mentioned Star Wars. And someone, or a team of sort of like three or five guys, had recreated a sort of 10-second, I would say, about 10 seconds of the X-Wing descent into the trench of the Death Star using CGI.
I know the one, the Corridor Crew one.
Yeah, I think that was it, yeah.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Amazingly impressive how they did it.
Corridor, we shouldn't be promoting people like this, I guess, but, you know, Corridor Crew do some very good, interesting VFX stuff. And if you're into that sort of idea of trying to, and they do a lot of historical stuff as well. So they will sit down and do a couch where they will look at stuff from Sinbad, or they'll look at stuff from 40s and 50s special effects, and try and work out from a modern day how they did it and then how you would do it now. There's some really good things about looking at the creativity of filmmaking that they do on their YouTube channel. So I feel kind of dirty promoting people for no reason, but if you're into talking about this sort of stuff, you know, it's fascinating, and it goes back to what you're saying, is, you know, you get the audience that you deserve. And they are kind of the same sort of audience as we are in sort of critiquing and pulling apart and seeing how things work and where they don't. And there's some really interesting things around FX. And I think, again, something like going back to Flux, which we said on the first, when we looked at the first episode, Gareth, is that I really quite like the fact that it was so clear that they'd overextended their budget on FX. And there were times it looked really quite ropey. And I felt that this season felt as much like the classic show that I've seen ever since it came back, in terms of not in terms of just having some ropey effects like Arc of Infinity, the floating in the ether in episode 2, was it, or 3? Episode 3. But also in terms of, I don't know, the sort of the craziness of serial formatting, where you don't really know where everything's going to go because everything's a little mad. And suddenly I felt I was transported back to that I was watching an episode like I would in the 80s. And I really wouldn't know how the episode would plot out in the 80s. Part 2 of Remembrance of the Daleks, you've got no clue where that's going to go. because you've got no idea where the format, there's no formatting. And oh, I felt that a lot with this.
Well, I suppose it's careering towards, let's be a little bit kind, you're right, to the ending of Flow. Yeah, if you've sat down and watched six parts of something in the 70s or four parts, it careers towards an end. And more often than not, the end is the doctor will try the humane thing and then go, oh, sod this. I'm going to put in a huge feedback loop and blow the thing up. We've got 8 minutes to get out, gentlemen. You know, and that's it. Boom. Job done. And that certainly wouldn't pass muster now. And yet we're totally fine with that. But because you accept that was how it was back then. I tell you what, one plot that didn't tie up for me, but you guys were paying more attention and you've chatted a lot, is the TARDIS being completely knackered in the first two or three episodes and falling apart and doors being all over the place. And then it seemed to be all right at the end. Or maybe it wasn't and they just stopped talking about it. Is the TARDIS buggered or...
They stopped talking about it, I think. And they started, I think, for the ease of shots. Because, again, this comes back to the question of had there been a political change in terms of the production, how much time they had or how much... Well, no, I'd suspect that had been done beforehand. I don't know. It certainly felt like by the back end, as far as I could see, the TARDIS was still looking a bit ropey in areas, but the shots didn't seem to be focusing on that anymore. And they seemed to be using the main doors all the time. Yeah. And it almost as if that had been forgotten, but was still there. Because, I mean, as far as we're aware, the universe is still buggered. There's nothing in the show which has suggested that the universe goes back to normal, despite the fact everyone seems to be quite happy at the end.
There was a mention about decompression, wasn't there? That it just being compressed and you could decompress it, and then I guess the universe all pops back.
I don't know. I mean, again, it's a frustrating end episode, because like we said... And it was horrible. I found it hard in episode 5, at the end of episode 5, thinking you've left us now with the Grand Serpent, Azure and Swarm. We now have Sontarans as well. We have the Flux and we have a lot of main characters and you've got an hour to finish this in. And it just suddenly felt like we were back to 2013 where you just knew that the whole thing would be a rush. And it's just like, why do you not learn from this? Why do you not learn that, you know, give people a satisfying ending. You can do shit for the rest of the time, but that last episode is so important because that's what people remember. And ultimately, if they do a rewatch, that's where they ultimately want to get to. So you want to make that a satisfying trajectory. And yeah, it's just so weird. You know, you kill off a popular character for no reason, less reason than Adric. He dies for no reason whatsoever. He does nothing just to make a point that, you know, he's done his life. You leave the world, universe fluxed. And if it's not fluxed, you haven't told the audience properly that it's been sorted. You've left the TARDIS in a state, you know, the TARDIS, which is often considered to be like, you know, the second main character of the show. No question about what happened there. You know, we don't talk about that. The characters, two characters that wandered around what was his name? My brain wants to say Jericho, but...
Yeah,
you know... It is Jericho. They don't seem sad that he's gone, which again is a very classic series. You know, there's just I think it's so frustrating when you don't get the emotional payoffs, because that's ultimately in drama what people are looking for at the back end of a story is the emotional payoffs. And you don't give it to them. And you just think it wouldn't have been hard to do that. It was a good experience. Like you said, I enjoyed watching all six episodes. I was just frustrated that the ending was just so.
Yeah, it may. I suppose if you've lost your act three, or you've ended up with a kind of stunted 45-minute act three, it just didn't give enough time to tie it up. But then you would expect him to start chucking things overboard, like unless the Grand. I suppose he's left the Grand Serpent on a rock, hasn't he? Which maybe he's coming back, maybe he's not, maybe he just has a scene. I don't know. I don't want to give the impression I didn't enjoy it, because I did enjoy it.
Same here.
Yeah.
So a lot of the individual episodes were really entertaining. I enjoyed them all. But the ending just didn't quite deliver. It's a shame.
It's just so weird, isn't it? Because, I mean, the Grand Serpent was really good in the sense that it was one of those rare moments in Doctor Who where you actually got to experience the universe without the Doctor, to see how it functions politically in areas, how people survive. And he was just, you know, an example of the sort of dickwads that exist you know, any time in space, nothing amazing. He'd be sort of wiped, you know, eventually after a few years, he'd be taken over by another Dick who would take his place. But it gave you a snapshot. And you don't get snapshots in Doctor Who because it's obviously too big concept. And then to sort of reintroduce him, somehow traveling back in time to take over UNIT, which he's now aware of, which is obviously why people like myself, you know, increasingly we're talking about, well, is it the Master? Because, you know, his knowledge was very specific of Earth, which exactly. I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
And he's just like, why do that? Why take this snapshot, make him into something relevant to the story and not relevant to the story, and thus almost sort of take away the snapshot, because now he's actually as important to the story as anything else. And that was a real shame. And yeah, I didn't get anything out of the UNIT stuff personally. I know some people did, but yeah, sorry.
But I mean, you can. I mean, there are examples where, for some reason, they replace the Master at quite short notice. So Talons of Wen Chiang, you know, it's far easier to watch that and go, yes, this should be the Master. He's falling apart. He's got a malfunctioning time machine. He's, you know, he's hiding away. It works perfectly with him as the Master. And it, obviously, the first drafts were, and then Philip went, no, we only had the Master last season. No, I don't want him. Away a few stories ago. No, I don't want him. Out he goes. Planet of Spiders. Clearly, that's supposed to be the final Delgado versus the Master, and you don't have Delgado, but they keep the story, and you get Lupton, and he sort of does all the things you'd expect off the Master in that storyline, but without being the Master. But this isn't a Master story, Flux. You're literally parachuting in this extra interesting character who deserved something of their own.
I mean, the reason I thought he was the Master was because he would be relevant to the story so far as if you're sort of saying you're destroying the universe. You know, what would the guy who likes to destroy the universe be doing in all this? You know, would he be, you know, is he as important to recognise as the Daleks or the Cybermen? And I thought that's why suddenly, okay, now I see why he's here. It's like, this makes sense. It makes me wonder, like you say.
Safe haven. They're stealing the last safe haven.
Yes.
And the Sontarans have got there first. Well, he needed the Sontarans to conquer it. So he then comes in, co-opts them, is then working on a way to get rid of them, and he then has the Earth. That makes perfect sense. It's a very master plan.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it isn't. And it doesn't quite... Yeah, it's odd, isn't it? It's odd. It's like echoes of an earlier draft. Sort of lingering.
Yes, I wonder that, whether there are echoes of earlier drafts, which, like you say, perhaps he just couldn't get rid of, or maybe, and again, as you say, it depends when, if there was any changes to his original story, they happened. Was this, you know, early on, or were there issues in production, which is when it would be six episodes, but maybe you had to make selective choices, or maybe, like you say, maybe it was the Master, and the last minute they realised they couldn't be, so he still existed in the story, but just had to sort of wash out. Because it kind of feels like when he has the Doctor tied up, or, you know, that is when there's going to be this thing. Is that, yes, don't you know who I am? And then, again, it's the Master. And it almost feels like at that point it's like, now we can't do this anymore. But you can't get rid of the person by then. I don't know. I'd love to know why that guy's there. I'd love to know what was going on in their heads.
It feels like you're right. It's an echo it's an echo of an earlier draft, but they've fallen in love with the idea of casting Doc Cotton. Which you would,
because he's brilliant.
And it's like, well, how can we keep this character? You know, we all do it. We all fall in love with a character who shouldn't be in there. There's loads of times when the Master's really had nothing to do with the plot. You know, Time and the Rani, not Time, no, Mark of the Rani, he literally turns up, pretends to be a scarecrow, drinks a few people, chuckles a bit, and wanders around mines. That's it. You could take him out of that plot, nothing changes, but it's still nice to see him. And maybe we're more forgiving of these things, you know, in the olden days. That you just go, oh yeah, of course he's come back. Yeah, got nothing to do. It's all right. And we're a bit more laser focusing on the new one. It must be very difficult. It's a difficult show to make. I wouldn't want to.
No, I agree. I mean, but like I said, like you said, I think, again, I really enjoyed it. It's the first time I've really enjoyed Doctor Who to that of watching each week that I've had possibly since 2005. So it's...
I watched nearly all of them live for the first time.
Yeah, same here.
you know, I didn't just go, oh, well, that can wait till tomorrow or that can wait till later. I literally watched them live and enjoyed them. So yeah, it's kind of like, I suppose it's 80% mission accomplished, which isn't bad.
I wanted to move on to a couple of slightly less entertaining. No, that's not right. Move on to a couple of... No, God, how am I going to do this? Okay.
I don't know, because you're now like a waiter who said you've enjoyed this dish. Well, we're now moving on to a less interesting dish. Here it comes. Do you enjoy this less tasty dish?
Gareth, over the years, I know that you have arranged various events and stuff and worked with people from Doctor Who. And I know a couple of people that you have invited to things and done things with have passed away lately. Now, a few weeks ago, Bob Baker passed away. And what was particularly surprising about it is I was watching him on my computer as a little favour to you a few days before that.
Oh, yes, with the Nightmare in Eden commentary.
Yeah.
I listened to only... I had to do some accounts myself, very tedious, on Saturday night. You know, I know how to live. and to liven this up, I just got the commentary track through that's on the Demons of Eden one shot. And I thought, well, I'll pop that on. And yeah, I mean, Bob was on absolute sparkling form.
Yeah.
And he seemed really proud of Nightmare of Eden, as he should be. And talking about big, long, boozy lunches with Douglas Adams, he reveals where his secret to writing science fiction is all down to this big explosive book of science where he'd dip into and pinch rough concepts and then, you know, fashion a sort of action story around, you know, stuff from this very good book, clearly. I loved it, and it lovely man. And it was quite sad to hear you know, he's gone, but that was the first I'd heard that commentary. So a lovely man. I owe him a great deal with Cutaway Comics, because he took a chance on us, gave us his big toys to play with. And, you know, he signed off all the stuff that's coming in the pipeline with Gods and Monsters, and we'll continue to tell great stories with his, you know, with his characters. But what a life, you know, and what a lovely man. And, you know, he's got the Matthew Sweet, the big Matthew Sweet interview coming on the season 17 box set in a few weeks. You know, God, what an age to live in. You know, season 17 for Christmas. Glorious, glorious. HD broadcast mastered Nymon. Ooh, you know. So yeah, it's a sad thing as we get older, and there's now only one writer alive from the 70s, Chris Boucher. That's it.
Wow.
It's, you know, is a sobering fact in itself, really.
I think Bob Baker was the last surviving writer from the Pertwee era, wasn't he?
He'd been that for a while. Yeah. That's right. There was him and Terence, and I think once Terence had gone, that was it. Did Terence write any for Pertwee, though? I think he just script edited, didn't he? Yeah, so it was Bob. Bob was the last man standing from Pertwee for a long time. And I think, you know, we're in an era where there's so few people left. I mean, one of the big guys, you know, the big Redwood still with us is obviously Hinchcliffe. So, funny enough, I was talking with, you know, we're working on the big Hinchcliffe book with Philip and Graham Burke at the moment. And that will be announced relatively soon and hopefully out later this year. But we're going for next year, we're going for a big, glorious, sumptuous coffee table, gorgeous artifact thing. So it will be lovely. And I know that Graham's talking to virtually everyone from the era who's still with us. But yeah, you realise that how precious some of these little stories are when they're gone. They're gone, you know. I didn't know about Bob's big book of science. I didn't know about Bob's fantastic boozy lunch with Douglas Adams. But at least we've captured some of those stories that we can enjoy in this mad old programme, which has gone on to become the most important show in British TV history and will never be surpassed. That's not a bad achievement for something that's been pretty much hated by its parent corporation for most of its life. Pretty good.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, someone else who's recently passed away is Chris Achilleos, and I remember an event that you held probably about 12, 15 years ago. I have no concept of time these days since having children.
I think it was about 10 years ago, yeah.
Right, maybe. Okay. And he spoke at it. I think it was based mostly about art in Doctor Who, but he refused a microphone, didn't he?
Which is... Oh, God. I mean, I have to preface this. You know, Chris's artwork is sublime.
Yeah.
And there's a reason it's so popular and so enduring. And he's been ripped off a lot since. But then Chris wasn't, you know, adverse to ripping off Jack Kirby and things like that. So it is a grand tradition that we're continuing. And I remember I rang him up in his studio and I said, we've got an event in Manchester. Want to come? Yeah, I'll come. And he had that brilliant, thick sort of Greek accent. And yeah, on the day, he turned up late, missed his train. I said, oh, you're late. And he says, oh, yes, that will be a headache for you because I had to buy another ticket. Ha ha, that will be another £90. I thought, okay. Then he had a good chat and everything was grand. And then we got him on. And poor old Aid Salmon, you know, I'd said to Aid doesn't really do many interviews. I said, can you interview Chris, artist to artist? Oh, yes, that would be grand. And then he did the old, no, I don't use microphones. And it was the most extraordinary experience, as you remember, with this softly spoken Greek Cypriot man talking in great detail about his work in a voice barely above a whisper. And everyone leaning in, that's my memory of almost being like a sort of a wall of people sort of looking at one man talking very softly about his style and his achievement. Yeah, it was quite so. I think that broke Aid that day. He never agreed to interview anyone after that. But fascinating guy, great talent. It was, you know, again, you realise, you know, how immortal. Yeah, you know, if Chris Achilleos hadn't done those Target books, he would still be as good or as great an artist, but he would not be anywhere near as known.
Mm.
So that's the power of our pulpy little show. And those pulpy little Target books, which you know, probably made most of us Doctor Who fans in the 70s, because it opened our minds to reading in a way that I don't think would have been otherwise. Although I will also say, it also meant that the only books I read for about 20 years had the word Doctor and Who in the title. You know, I don't think I read anything else, so maybe it wasn't as much of a problem as it was a good thing. But no, it was a good day, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Anthony Dry got to meet him, because that was his great hero.
Yeah.
And you know, Anthony has, you know, had really homaged his style and done it in a beautiful way. So, yeah. What do you remember of him?
I'm largely what you're saying there. I remember getting as close as possible when it became clear that he wasn't using a microphone and you couldn't hear him. And I do think I may have tried to record it on a phone, but that if that file ever existed, it didn't pick anything up.
No. You heard a lot of breathing.
Lots of chairs squeaking as people leaning closer.
Oh, that was quite an experience, that, wasn't it? I've never had... I wish he'd said he was microphone phobic. You know, I mean, God, we could have at least had a sign language guy behind him.
Or we could have got a boom or something.
Could have done something, couldn't we? I mean, it was but that was, you know, he was quite a kind of you know, he was a commercial artist. He was a little bit random. But oddly enough, I did get some nice signed prints off him that day, which are up in my bathroom. So I went for Planet of the Daleks, which is the first Target book I ever read, from Llandudno Library, and Revenge of the Cybermen, which is my absolute favourite. What are your favourite Achilleos covers then, boys?
I'll let James answer. I'll have to give it some thought.
Why?
Lie.
I said why. I mean, his work was very distinctive, and I think it's fascinating how, when it comes to sort of, when it came to sort of doing not the reprints, but sort of almost like trying to capture the aesthetic of Doctor Who books for people who yearn for that, to remember that, how that was synonymous with what Doctor Who books were. And funnily enough for me, I suppose, I'm not a little bit young, but my memory of Doctor Who books is obviously when you get to the 80s, late 70s, 80s, where the artwork becomes far more spread out and his work becomes far less visible. as the reprints don't tend to use it. So I was never in. It wasn't part of my nostalgia. So while I remember, I always remember his artwork, or especially some of the John Pertwee stuff. It was not part of my Doctor Who novels. My Doctor Who novels were far more ugly.
Yeah, mine is sort of halfway in between. The ones I would buy from the shop were almost always the photo covers. But
yeah,
if I got them from the library, then they were Chris Achilios.
I don't remember much of Achilios stuff, but I remember some old battered copies in the library of the Daleks, I think, in my school library. But, you know, the ones I can remember, yes, is either the photo art or the sort of stuff you get later on with the sort of Terror of the Autons, Unearthly Child, and you get these sort of very differently painted sort of work, which is far less stylistic. It's far less collectible.
I wonder if Achilios had withdrawn the rights to use his art then, because he's ceased. There was a tribute on Facebook from one of the artists of the era. I think it might have been Jeff Dunham, who was thanking him. He said, you know, you did so much to assert the rights of Doctor Who artists. You know, you made sure we got our original art back. You asserted your copyright over the image. So I wonder if if all those new covers you're talking about are basically him saying, no, you can't use it, or I want another fee. I want 500 quid. They go, no. Find someone who'll do it for a ton. Because you would reuse those covers because they're iconic and brilliant. But I guess at the time they were going, no, I'm not paying that, or no, you're taking the mick, or Achilios isn't willing to lend them the originals. I have seen a lot of the originals, actually. I mean, there was that brilliant exhibition at the cartoon museum 10 years ago. And it was quite a thrill to see some of these covers are in the flesh, although interesting how small a lot of them were. I think Jeff Cummins' covers in particular, bloody tiny. They're not far off painted to scale.
Wow.
I mean, the one that I always remember frustrating me again is the Daleks, because it has that police box on the cover and it doesn't have half the panels.
Oh.
And as I remember as a child, that was deeply distressing for me. I think, funnily enough, for me, my nostalgia memories of his covers come from the audio range that came out, 15, 20 years ago, where we've got William Russell doing the for the Daleks and the Crusade, and they reused those covers for that. And I love those. I still have my tin box of the Daleks, Web Planet and Dalek Invasion, read by William Russell, and each box has got his artwork on it, and I still love those adapts. So he sort of connects to me for a far later period than the period of my childhood, when all these covers were just, you know, they just weren't really there anymore. I picture going into shops and WH Smith's and seeing a whole range of ugly covers.
Yeah, I mean, it was a thrill, his first run. I mean, I remember it always made them stand out. I mean, if you look at some of the, you're right, some of the reprints are pretty poor. Well, you know, the ones they replaced them with. I think Achilios does the Crusades, doesn't he?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, the reprint of that I remember being uniquely dreadful.
Crusades is a really nice one as well.
It's a gorgeous piece, isn't it? There's a few that they replaced, which just, I can only guess that Chris was just said, no, you can't use them, or yes, you can use them, you know, put your fee proposal to me. But thanks to that, these originals still exist and are in private collections to be enjoyed. I mean, there's one prominent fan, I've been to his house, and he's got about seven of them, and they are just incredible things.
I'm just going on to the internet and just having a look at something to refresh me.
I think Three Doctors was
done, but that's not bad. I think that's a Jeff Cummins one, and that's bad. It's not quite as good as the Galactus ripoff one, obviously, which is very iconic, but still not bad.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, the ones when I say they weren't ugly, they were just, the consistency was gone that you had in the 70s, where you had some very vibrant, you know, and the 60s, 70s covers. I mean, I remember, like, who did the Fearless Ones cover? Because, again, it wasn't mind-blowing, but it had a police box on it, and that was enough for me, I'm afraid. But
Faceless.
Faceless. I've said Fearless. They've even written Fearless in
Bane and a TARDIS, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. Yeah, there was still some really striking covers in there that were, which were good.
Skillet as Gunfighters, which I think is the zenith of his airbrush style, is beautiful. And really, really, really works on every level. And there are some, it is a bit more hit and miss when you get to the 80s. The Crotons, I seem to remember being quite nice. And then I suppose you then get to Alistair Pearson with his very intricate painted style and a very unique feel, which isn't just aping Achilleos. It moved away from that shadow and it's doing something of its own.
Yes.
And then then you're right. And then the experimental period is over. Now it's like, no, we'd like Alice to do them all, please.
Yes. And
get to the closest to a new Achilleos era that you're going to get.
Yeah, because I mean, I remember that was the time I was reading Doctor Who Monthly, and you know, you'd often get the latest artwork for Remembrance of the Daleks, you know, for the cover of that, which would be ruined by the way that they placed the logo on it. But
that's right, but they would always show a picture of Alistair holding the original artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would give you a sense. Yeah, that's right. Some Ghostlight, I remember, being a particularly fine cover.
Yes.
There's some lovely, lovely artwork in
there. Yeah. And then you've got, I'll just say, the photo ones. I'm looking at the Terminus cover now, which is absolutely horrific.
That's all down to Davison's agent, isn't it? Rejecting the art for the Visitation.
Yeah, so you've got this faded orange sort of fade effect, and then you've got the Black Guardian and the Doctor cut into each other as a sort of
It's a dreadful
collage. Era. It's terrible.
And Force of Doomsdays is particularly uninspiring, as I recall. Just the Monarch sitting there. But I think it's interesting, as you say, how this all ties for a television show, how much the creativity and the aesthetics of its ancillary sort of merchandise is, and how powerful and potent it was, and how beautifully created it was as well. It kind of reminds me of like the 2000 AD era, where you've got an era of that, so 70s and 80s, where you've got very stylized artists, a lot of European artists as well, sort of really shifting and changing the understanding and the sort of pop value of art, of illustration.
Yeah, those books were basically streaming before it existed, and they were incredibly important, because I was trying to explain this, I think, to an American chap I was on a podcast with a while ago, and it made Britain of the 70s and 80s sound a bit like Albania, and maybe we were. We had three channels, and one of them seemed to exclusively show snooker or the money program. And one of them was brilliant. It was all Benny Hill and George and Mildred and no money program. And then you had BBC, which was trying to be sort of part school, part highbrow. And then for 23 minutes a week for half of the year, we got something wonderful. And then everything went back to being beige or or Kojak or the Generation Game or Grandstand, showing us the Egg and Spoon race from Goodwood, you know, for an hour. So it was amazing how important these little books were, because we literally, everything else was pretty rubbish. And well, maybe we went off Albanian telly.
I mean, I remember, you know, like for Blake 7, I remember you'd watch it and I think it would be Question of Sport before it. And at certain times of the year, it would be, or for a while, do you remember Triangle, the terrible soap?
He either chain smoked a whole pack watching that.
You know, that was what you had. You know, these, you say, these things stood out as gems.
Yeah.
And then that was reflected in, that was, you know, for that 23-50 minutes, you want content, you want more content, and that was all you had, was the novelizations and the you know, later on, obviously, the magazines, and as we've said before, me and Christian many times, the Peter Haining books and you know, novelizations and Peter Hainings, and that was it.
Well, do you know, I wonder if sometimes the anger that we've seen in, you know, the last 10 years about the direction of the show and when it's disappointed is an echo of this 23 minutes a week is all we've got to look forward to. That when the show is misfiring, it's like there's a big part of our life that's misfiring. And it doesn't matter now because, God, there's so many great things we watch. If Doctor Who is off form for a year, there's a little bit of so what. I mean, I know cancellation anxiety then kicks in, which is another echo of the previous era. But if, you know, if Doctor Who's great, then it's great. If Doctor Who's okay, it's okay. If Doctor Who's poor, you have a choice to watch other things. Or if it's not for you, you have a choice to watch other things. So I wonder if it's an anxiety echo from over the era of, you know, what are we going to do now? You know, God, you even my 23 minutes of pleasure cannot be guaranteed now.
But is that an echo? It feels different because it feels like before it was an anxiety because you had so little. I mean, I agree with you. I remember, you know, when Doctor Who went off the air in 89, it was like, what else is there? There was nothing else.
Nothing.
But now it feels like it's almost, you know, it's that very much social media staking opinion as territory. And, you know that you might not even be watching that show. You might stop watching it, but you'll still comment on it because it's your, you know, your world is now bigger by being smaller, that your world extends to your reach on social media. And that's your say is a far more like a gospel. And I get that kind of feeling. Like, with, again, going back to Cowboy Bebop, there were people there going, yeah, glad that we've won. That show's been cancelled. Good. It was, you know. And it's like, what have you won? You've won nothing. The show was, whether the show was there or not, you didn't have to watch it. You've encouraged Netflix not to invest in that sort of show coming from that sort of adaptation pool again. Well done. But that victory over opinion over any sort of practical success seems to grind a lot of the Doctor Who debate at the moment, because you kind of feel that if people are dissatisfied with Doctor Who and it disappeared, they wouldn't care that much because they'd just be watching, you know, Lost in Space or, you know, something else, probably not Lost in Space, a Transformers film. So yeah, it's different.
There's other things. I mean, it's I've kind of stopped watching the Marvel movies. I felt I was done after Endgame, and that doesn't mean that what comes after it's terrible. It's just I seem to have lost my enthusiasm to get up off the sofa, wander across town, and sit down in the cinema. Now, I might enjoy what I see in there, but I just can't be arsed. And that doesn't mean I wish they don't exist. But there's something unique with Doctor Who where we're kind of, it still has the capacity to wound and irritate and elate in a way that no other show does.
Wound, irritate, and elate.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. I know. There's a sort of Dalek, a Dalekese about it, isn't there? Yeah. It's just
irritation of the Daleks.
Well, I think it's always a shame for a show as well, which in theory, its memory and its content has always been about being progressive, about taking risks, about challenging, which invariably is always going to be contentious if you challenge. And yet,
sure. I mean, could you imagine being a dedicated churchgoer at the same time as they're still writing chapters of the Bible?
But I mean, we were, you know, I know this again sounds odd, you know.
No, if you're into church, you've got a book that has a definite beginning, middle, and end. And that's it. Nobody is writing lots and lots and lots of chapters of the Bible, like some endless thing, and then actually saying, oh yeah, I know you lot really like Corinthians, but do you know what? We've just overwritten that. It's rubbish. Here's your new version. And I guess it's that anxiety that someone is taking something off you, as opposed to just going, do you know what? I still love season 17. That exists. It's on my shelf. You can't take it away. If this new one isn't for me, it's irritating because I'm not at the party in the way that I want to be at the party, but hey.
But it's still there. There is the echo, as you said. Like, you know, I mean, we're up back in the 80s. We'll remember how you know, people look to Davison and sneered at it as being a bad situation to, or Colin Baker, or God, Sylvester McCoy, which is now largely considered a golden era. Mm-hmm. Even the McGann film is now the golden era. And yet we remember the reactions of the time of the show was coming to an end or it was lost its way.
I remember going on the internet for almost the first time and finding a Doctor Who discussion on Usenet about how terrible the TV movie was and how it was the end of Doctor Who.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, people scream for McGann now. You know,
let's be honest. The TV movie, the plot makes no sense, but the ingredients are good.
Yeah.
McGann is good. The look of it is good. The pace is good. I really like Eric Roberts's, you know, campy master. I think. it's very enjoyable. I don't think about the plot in any way, shape or form. In the same way that if you think about Gremlins, that all falls apart. The minute you have at midnight, you know, this world is going to fall apart. You go, well, which midnight? And they brilliantly riff on that in Gremlins too, don't they? Where they start taking the concept apart. So, but the main thing, the performance, the feel of that Doctor is right. So, yeah. God, we've always got to have something to moan about. But I tell you what is funny, which we don't have because, and it's good that you mentioned that about the TV movie. The general audience will have watched that and not thought about Doctor Who then until it comes back with Russell. The rest of us are, you know, obsessively, you know, dealing with the fallout for that for 8 years. So in the same way where I might now sit down with Coronation Street once in a blue moon, or worse, sit down, watch it with my mother, because she watches it religiously. And then we have the same conversation where I'll ask her, who's this person? Who's this person? Mm. Are they dead? Oh, she's going out with him now. Oh, what's this? And it drives her insane. It drives her absolutely insane. You know, can't you just watch this? I'll tell you in the advert break. No, yes, no. It's so funny. So it's not for everyone. But I guess if someone's enjoying it and they've still got a reason to make it, it's irritating maybe that we're not at the party, but someone is, I guess.
Just out of interest, you know, to buy extra media, something we mentioned the other week, which I thought was kind of interesting. Did you notice the sort of a far more binding of Big Finish to the sort of like to the BBC distribution promote, you know, to its sort of promotional arm, that, you know, Big Finish is now mentioned far more on, say, their YouTube channels, on Twitter, that there seems to be in the last couple of years, a sort of far more of an embrace to actually tie that in as part of that sort of commercial arm, while before it always seemed to sit like separate.
It makes perfect sense. I mean, they are branded as Doctor Who. They're using, you know, they are the repository for classic Doctor Who and will be for some time. And I guess as, you know, the BBC's classic Doctor Who offer has a finite shelf life to it because there's nothing really that can come after the Blu-ray set. It just makes perfect sense.
I just wondered if you'd noticed it just seemed to be a shift.
Well, I mean, I guess they've got a license till 2030.
Yep.
Russell does go down this, you know, let's proliferate our Doctor Who content across platforms, then. And all of the Blu-ray box sets have got to be out by 2025, I would have thought. Because if we're getting 3 a year, that's about right. And maybe more in the anniversary year, which it still feels amazingly, even though it's 12 months away, is a bit quiet. It makes sense that you basically leave them to it. And, you know, they've got so much stuff banked. I mean, Tom Baker could be in the ground tomorrow and we'll be still hearing him for 3 years. Which I think would please him immensely.
Undoubtedly, which I think is a good time for us to bring this podcast to a close.
It's been an epic chat.
It has been an epic. So a big thanks to James McLean and Gareth Cavana for joining me. We'll be back with a new podcast soon. Until then, it's goodbye.